What if I told you that your DNA was on her?
I don't know how my DNA got on her.
Okay.
Like, no way, no nothing, no how.
Halloween was fast approaching in Mabee, Michigan on the 24th of October 2014. In preparation, people were putting the final touches to their Halloween costumes and making sure that their candy bowls were well stocked. That night, a massive Halloween party was being held nearby in Newport. Around 600 people gathered at the party, flaunting their costumes, watching the bands and having some drinks. However, amidst the lively celebration, an ominous presence lurked among the guests, harboring sinister intentions. Chelsea Brock was born on the 28th of January 1992 in Trenton, Wayne County, Michigan. Her parents, Matthew and Leanne de Brock, raised her in a deeply Catholic household, and Chelsea held the position of the youngest among her five siblings. The family then moved to Mabee in Michigan. During her formative years, Chelsea attended St. Patrick Elementary School, and later she was enrolled at Monroe High School. Her warm and genuine nature made it effortless for her to forge friendships with her peers. Her sister, Cassandra, affectionately reminisced about her, saying, "She was so full of love. She loved everyone." After completing high school, Chelsea took her first steps towards independence by securing a job as a hostess at Olga's Kitchen in the Mall of Monroe. Chelsea was a true homebody who relished the simple pleasures of life. She found joy in watching movies, particularly musicals, and she harbored a profound love for music, with Queen being a particular favorite. Additionally, she had a penchant for video games, especially immersing herself in the Final Fantasy series. On the weekends, Chelsea could be found in the kitchen, baking, or curled up on the sofa with a good book. She had dreams and ambitions to attend Monroe Community College to pursue a culinary degree. On the 24th of October 2014, anticipation hung in the crisp autumn air. It was Friday night and 22-year-old Chelsea Brock had received an invitation to a Halloween party off Post Road in Newport. The event was set in a field just behind the rustic property of Michael Williams, the lead singer of the band Pickaxe Preacher. Michael was known for hosting two legendary parties each year. One in June to celebrate summer's arrival, and another one close to Halloween. These gatherings were always the talk of the town, characterized by top-tier entertainment and unforgettable experiences. Michael had organized live bands and a roaring bonfire for this particular night. Michael recalled of the party.
It's a costume party. I usually have like 10 bands. Get like a circus tent. It's usually real well planned in advance. I've been doing it for 10 years.
Chelsea had spent several weeks fashioning a Poison Ivy costume from the Batman franchise. Her costume featured a green leotard, adorned with leaves and flowers, complemented by black leggings. Atop her head sat an auburn red and purplish wig, and she carried a bottle of wine to emulate the poison container associated with her character. At about 10 p.m, Chelsea was picked up by her friend and co-worker, Laura Taylor. She kissed her mother goodbye, told her that she loved her, and said she would see her in the morning. Chelsea's mother, Leander, recalled. She was excited to wear it. She had commented that she was hoping to win the prize for the best original costume. Chelsea brought along with her a change of clothing, a purse, her cell phone, and an overnight bag. Upon arrival at the party, she left these items in Laura's car. The party was already in full swing by the time they arrived, exceeding everybody's expectations in terms of its size. The field was teeming with approximately 600 attendees, including college students, adults, and even some high school students. Many in attendance were wearing Halloween costumes, and some were even wearing masks. Chelsea and Laura reunited with friends at the party, enjoying drinks and the live band performances. At some point during the night, Chelsea accidentally ran into a wooden post, resulting in minor injuries to her forehead and the bridge of her nose. Her friend Penny Watkins recalled,
"After the music stopped playing, they lit the bonfire on the other side of the yard, and as we're walking over there, there's this pavilion type structure, and she like hit the bridge of her nose on a piece of wood. We were kind of being distracted and goofy, and she didn't see it coming. She wasn't bleeding or anything, but when you hit your nose, sometimes it hurts really bad, and she was in some pain, and I told her to take some drinks. I had some vodka."
Chelsea brushed off the mishap, and the fun of the night continued. At about 1 a.m, her friend Laura decided to call it a night. When she sought out Chelsea to bid her farewell, she found herself unable to locate her in the sprawling sea of partygoers. Laura proceeded to her parked car, retrieved Chelsea's bag, purse, and cell phone.
Chelsea had originally called me off a weird number that I didn't know, and I told her I'd be up by the fire in a minute, and I would give her phone and her stuff. Instead, Becky ended up calling me, getting her phone from me for Chelsea.
Laura had planned on giving the belongings back to Chelsea, but she then received a phone call from their mutual friend, Becky Brinson, who came and retrieved the belongings instead. Becky then searched for Chelsea, but she couldn't find her. She too left that night, but made the commitment to deliver Chelsea's belongings to her home the following day. The next morning, Chelsea's parents awaited her return, expecting her home sometime between 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. However, Chelsea never arrived. Concern quickly escalated when their attempts to contact her through her cell phone revealed that it had never been returned to her, and she hadn't spent the night at a friend's house. Fear began to grip Leander and Matthew, and joined by some of Chelsea's friends, they initiated a search for her. Their quest began in the vicinity where the party had taken place, and soon expanded into a wider search radius, their voices calling on Chelsea's name. Leander recalled, "I said, how are we ever going to find her with a green costume in a field of green? I just started to scream her name." As the hours passed without any sign of Chelsea, concern deepened. Knowing that Chelsea didn't drive, they realized that she couldn't have left the party on her own, at least not in a car anyway. Fueled by growing worry, her parents promptly reported her missing, harboring strong suspicions that something sinister had happened to their daughter. She was not the type to vanish without informing them of her whereabouts, as her sister, Cassie, affirmed, stating, "I think she's in distress. She's not one to do anything like this. She always calls, she always comes home." Family and friends attested to Chelsea's well-rounded character. She wasn't involved in drugs and she had no known enemies. Their anxieties intensified when they discovered that Chelsea's cell phone, social media accounts and bank account had remained untouched since the night of the party. Had she decided to disappear voluntarily, she would have needed money and a cell phone. The initial focal point of the investigation for detectives centered on the location of the party, Michael Williams' property. Detectives swiftly arrived and commenced a thorough search of his home, along with the surrounding fields and woodlands where the party had taken place. Their vigilant search was aimed at uncovering any potential evidence that might provide a crucial lead, whether that be an article of clothing, a piece of jewellery, or any other significant clue. Michael, the host of the party, cooperated fully with the investigation, though he mentioned that he hadn't personally seen Chelsea during the event. Given the large number of attendees, this really wasn't that surprising. He asserted that he was familiar with Chelsea, as she had attended several of his parties in the past with friends and family. Michael stated, "Yeah, there's some guilt. That's why I've been doing everything I can to cooperate with everybody. I'm extremely sorry. I've been posting about it on Facebook. I've been trying to make awareness. I hope to God they find her." He confirmed that the party had spiraled out of control, with an overwhelming number of attendees prompting him to turn people away and eventually shut down the party entirely. Despite the exhaustive search efforts in the area, nothing of significance was uncovered. It was almost as though Chelsea had vanished into thin air. Detectives returned to the vicinity the following day, deploying additional resources such as a helicopter, a sniffer dog, and an eight-wheeled all-terrain vehicle to comb through the backwoods. Simultaneously, thousands of missing person flyers were printed, describing Chelsea as approximately 5 feet 7 inches tall and weighing around 140 pounds with blonde hair and green eyes. One identifying feature noted was Chelsea's tattoo of an anchor behind her right ear. These missing person flyers were distributed throughout the area by Chelsea's family and concerned locals. Her mother, Leanda, expressed her anguish, stating, "It's every parent's worst nightmare. This is not supposed to happen in a small town in farm country, USA. I'm hurting. I love her and I want her back. She's my kid." That evening, the community and Chelsea's loved ones gathered for a candlelight vigil at Heck Park in Monroe County, Frenchtown Township. A large assembly of people held their candles tightly, their flickering flames illuminating the dark evening sky. Prayers were offered for Chelsea's safe return, and her sister addressed the crowd, stating, "We just want to know where she is. Think if it was your sister." Approximately 90 people attended the vigil, led by Deacon George Cusino, who shared the role with Chelsea's parents, Matthew and Leanda, as well as their two other daughters, Megan and Cassandra. The deacon stated, "We're here to pray with one another, to love and support one another. Prayer goes with you as you drive home." Mary and Joseph were troubled too when they lost their son Jesus for a few days. "We ask the Good Shepherd to bring our daughter and friend back to us safe and sound." In their quest for answers, detectives diligently interviewed other guests who attended the Halloween party that night. Detective Brian Soroka recalled,
"Like I said, we use the media to request information to the public. We requested everybody that attended the party or had any information to contact us. So we had a phone number that people called tips into. Whenever a citizen would call or somebody with some information, we'd open the tip and it would be assigned to an investigator to investigate that."
Numerous individuals had crossed paths with Chelsea during the critical hours between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. after her friends had left. At about 1 a.m., she approached a man named Gavin Hullett. He told detectives that she was crying and asked if she could use his cell phone because her friends had left without her. Around an hour after this, Chelsea approached a girl named Alexandra Fraunhofer and asked to use her cell phone to try and get a lift home from the party. According to a man selling band merchandise at the party, he saw Chelsea speaking with a man shortly before she vanished at about 3 a.m. The man in question was described as a white man of medium build, with medium length, dark hair, a thin moustache, and facial hair. He was dressed in a plain black hoodie, and he wore black framed glasses. The eyewitness noted that Chelsea and this man proceeded in the direction of the parked cars at the intersection of Post and William Roads. No signs of distress or irregularity were apparent, suggesting that Chelsea appeared to be in the company of this man voluntarily. This revelation significantly concerned the detectives, prompting them to conduct further interviews with partygoers to establish whether anybody had witnessed additional details. They sought to determine whether Chelsea and the man in question had entered a vehicle or whether she had been spotted returning to the party, either alone or still with this man. Unfortunately, however, this marked the last known sighting of Chelsea at the party, intensifying fears that she might have fallen victim to a sinister event involving this unidentified man. Her friend Brittany commented on this, stating, "You think it was wrong place, wrong time. Maybe someone took advantage. I don't want to, you know, think that way, but I'm just trying to hope for the best." Detectives were determined to piece together Chelsea's movements that night, appealing to more attendees for information. However, they encountered challenges due to the fact that many partygoers were in costume, and many admitted to being under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Despite these obstacles, some attendees provided photographs that they had taken during the event, with one particular photo standing out. This photograph depicted Chelsea in a group with several young men and women. The Monroe County Police posted the image on their Facebook page, requesting identification from the individuals present. All of the people featured in the photograph eventually contacted detectives. They were ruled out as persons of interest. Then on October 29th, detectives released a composite sketch of the man seen walking towards the parked cars with Chelsea. Unfortunately, neither Chelsea's friends and family, nor anybody else at the party interviewed by detectives, could identify the man based on the sketch. Time continued to crawl at an agonizingly slow pace for Chelsea's anxious loved ones. As Halloween night descended, instead of partaking in the festivities, they found themselves battling the chilly weather, distributing missing person flyers, and relentlessly scouring for any elusive clue that might lead them to Chelsea. A makeshift command center took shape, within a tent stationed at the very spot where Chelsea had last been seen, walking alongside an unknown man towards parked cars. Volunteers poured in from different counties, a testament to the collective determination to bring Chelsea back home safe. Each day they convened at the command center, scrutinizing a map of Monroe County and meticulously devising search strategies. Even those unable to physically join the search offered their unwavering support by ensuring the searchers remained nourished and hydrated. Matthew and Leander gratefully acknowledged the overwhelming assistance, with Leander conveying her unyielding hope, stating, "I'm full of hope. If I give up, then all these people won't be here." By the fifth day of the search, over 3,000 flyers had been distributed throughout the area, with more than 100 individuals assisting detectives in the tireless physical search. Many of these searchers had no physical connection to Chelsea, but were deeply moved by her unsettling disappearance. Rachel Lynn Madden spoke with the Monroe News and said, "It just hits too close to home. You hear all the time about these crazy things happening to young girls." In addition to the bustling command center, an unused office space within the shuttered Monroe Bank and Trust branch on Swan Creek Road in Newport emerged as the headquarters for the Find Chelsea Brock movement. A dedicated Facebook page was established, with volunteers streaming into the office to allocate unsearched group areas. Chelsea's three devoted sisters, Cassie, Megan, and Jennifer, consistently led the charge, arriving at the crack of dawn and departing only as darkness fell each night. The search efforts began at the precise location where Chelsea was last sighted, and then radiated outward into the sprawling landscape. Fields and dense woodlands were methodically combed, with searchers meticulously inspecting ditches and peering under foliage, hoping to unearth any semblance of evidence guiding them towards Chelsea's whereabouts. The family had also initiated a GoFundMe campaign to support their search. Then on the 4th of November, Crime Stoppers announced a $1,000 cash reward for any information leading to Chelsea's discovery. While the overwhelming majority of the community united in their tireless efforts to bring Chelsea home, a thorn emerged among the roses. In early November, somebody began meticulously tearing down the missing person flyers scattered throughout the vicinity. As the calendar turned to the 5th of November, detectives released some footage hoping it might jog someone's memory. This footage featured Chelsea in a music video shot at the same location of the Halloween party from the preceding summer. Approximately 200 individuals had attended this summer gathering, with Chelsea herself dressed in a white t-shirt and black trousers. The video was a production for Michael's band, Pickaxe Preachers, incorporating scenes from his summer bash, and Chelsea made several appearances throughout the footage. At this juncture in the investigation, detectives had conducted interviews with 138 individuals and had sifted through 285 leads. While each lead was pursued with utmost diligence, none furnished the elusive clue that could lead to Chelsea. Astoundingly, despite Chelsea's baffling disappearance of 11 days, detectives held steadfast in their belief that she remained unharmed. Sheriff Dale Malone stated during a press conference, we have no reason to believe she's not alive. However, the lingering uncertainty persisted. Chelsea had sustained injuries to her forehead and the bridge of her nose when she collided with a wooden post during the party, sparking speculation that she may have become disoriented. Her family acknowledged this possibility, but expressed that if that were the case, Chelsea would have likely reappeared by now. The extensive searches conducted in the vicinity of the party's location yielded no trace of evidence, intensifying concerns of a potential abduction. On November 8th, the search operation escalated, with the arrival of 80 professional firefighters from multiple counties in the region. They meticulously searched approximately 70 acres in the fields near the Halloween party site, but their exhaustive efforts yielded nothing. Fire Chief Mark Nicolai somberly reflected on their search, remarking, "We went through those areas with a fine-tooth comb. We found nothing, and I'm pretty confident it was a very detailed search." With the unfruitful searches, Chelsea's loved ones were determined to keep her disappearance at the forefront of everyone's minds. Chelsea's favourite colour was purple, so they began a purple ribbon campaign. They asked supporters to wear purple ribbons, purple bracelets, or tie purple ribbons at their homes. Kathy Dauberstein, co-owner of North Monroe Floral Boutique, began giving away large purple bows that could be tied to trees or posts. On the weekend, volunteers gathered at LaRanger Square to decorate the town in purple. The entire community were there to offer support, and Detroit Metro Airport even allowed missing person flyers to be distributed to passengers. Chelsea's mother stated, "The eyes of the world are literally watching out for Chelsea. We're not done, and we're not giving up." Then on the 15th of November, the reward fund was increased by Crime Stoppers from $1,000 to $7,000. Halloween has always been my favourite time of the year. I take pride in decking out my home with spooky decorations, from light-up pumpkins and skeletons to candles emitting those quintessential fall scents. Yet one thing I can't stand is the struggle to locate my stash of Halloween decorations. If you can relate, here's the ideal solution: Smart Labels. With Smart Labels, you can effortlessly catalogue your storage bins using their user-friendly app and QR code stickers. This means you'll always know which bin contains what, from the label's colour to the unique code. Just search for Halloween on their app, and hey presto, it will tell you exactly what storage bin your decorations are in. Alternatively, you can scan the QR code on your storage bin to instantly access a detailed inventory of its contents. Say goodbye to spending endless minutes rummaging through bins. Get straight to decorating this holiday season. To begin, just visit qrsmartlabels.com or check out Amazon or Walmart for their convenient QR labels. Then download the Smart Labels app from the Apple App Store or Google Play to simplify your storage management. Say hello to hassle-free decorating with Smart Labels. The next day, even more members of the community came out to decorate the town. They affixed 35 purple Christmas wreaths on streetlight poles and the gazebo in LaRanger Square. It had now been 1 month since Chelsea vanished, and there hadn't been a single reported sighting of her. Before the end of the month, the reward fund was increased once more to $17,000, a fine incentive for anybody who may have been harbouring some information. Matthew and Leanda held a press conference shortly thereafter. The grief on their face was evident as they begged for information. Matthew pleaded that if somebody had Chelsea, to please release her and allow her to come back home. His voice quivered with emotion as he directed a statement at Chelsea, telling her, "If you're out there and you can hear me, now is the time to break free from your captors." Leanda said that they were still searching for Chelsea and would never give up until they found her. She also asked that if anybody had any additional photographs or videos of the Halloween party, to get in contact with detectives. By December, the reward fund was increased once more, this time up to $25,000. Christmas came and went, but it was a somber event for the Brock family, with Chelsea still missing. As the new year unfolded, fresh developments emerged in the unsolved case, resulting in the arrest and subsequent charges of a man and woman for providing false information to detectives. Kerry Carr had previously informed detectives that an ex-boyfriend was responsible for Chelsea's murder, alleging that he had killed her and then buried her in a cemetery in Perrysburg, Ohio. According to Kerry, her ex-boyfriend had attended the Halloween party with the sinister intention of ending Chelsea's life, driven by a motive rooted in revenge. She further claimed that this murder was carried out as a favour to his friend, who she asserted had been Chelsea's former boyfriend. Harlan Bird, too, had recounted a false narrative to detectives, asserting that he had assisted a bloody Chelsea into a car at the Halloween party. He described witnessing two men harassing Chelsea, who was lying on the floor bleeding. He claimed he helped her into a departing vehicle. Detectives had diligently pursued these leads, only to discover that they were entirely fabricated. Eventually, Harlan admitted to detectives that he had concocted the entire tale in an effort to portray himself as a hero. Kerry's motivation, on the other hand, stemmed from a desire for retribution against her ex-boyfriend. Sergeant Jeff Pauley weighed in on the charges, noting that individuals sometimes provide false information to police, but deliberately crafted fictitious stories not only squander detectives' valuable time, but also nurtures false hope. He remarked, "Maybe they just want to get involved. I don't know. Maybe they want the attention. They get caught up." As time pressed on, the influx of tips dwindled, and by February, detectives remained no closer to uncovering Chelsea's whereabouts than they had been on the day she vanished. However, the following month would breathe new life into the investigation with a significant discovery. On the 22nd of March, while Cheryl Retzlaff was busy cleaning her yard, she stumbled upon a woman's discarded shoe in a nearby bush. Cheryl resided on War Road, not far from the location of the Halloween party, prompting her to wonder if the discovery held any significance. Detectives promptly arrived at the scene, retrieved the shoe, and photographed it. They later showed the image to Chelsea's mother, Leander, who immediately recognized it as belonging to her daughter. Fast forward to March 28th, when a man named Eric Kassab was scouring through an abandoned industrial area at Freeland and Peters Road in Flat Rock in search of scrap metal. This once bustling 60-acre site had previously housed Specialty Petroleum, but it now lay desolate and overgrown. During his exploration, Eric stumbled upon a piece of Chelsea's handmade poison ivy leotard and the wig she had worn to the Halloween party. Unaware of Chelsea's disappearance at the time, he left the costume where he found it. However, a few days later, upon seeing Chelsea's missing person flyer, he made the connection. Initially, Eric was apprehensive about reporting the discovery. He had handled the costume and feared that his DNA might have been found on it. Additionally, he worried about potential trespassing charges for venturing onto the derelict property. Nevertheless, on April 5th, he decided to contact the detectives, who promptly arrived at the scene. They collected the items and sent them for forensic examination by a Michigan State Police specialist. Upon examination, it was observed that the leotard had been torn or cut at both shoulders and the crotch. DNA testing confirmed that the leotard had indeed belonged to Chelsea. Furthermore, analysis revealed the presence of two large areas of bloodstains on the inner lining, as well as male DNA on the leotard straps and crotch. This information was swiftly uploaded to the combined DNA index system, but unfortunately no matching profile was found. Detectives persevered in their search for the abandoned area, hoping to unearth additional evidence that might provide leads to Chelsea's whereabouts. Meanwhile, on the 24th of April, a man named John Marcon was working on his 13-acre undeveloped land near Briar Hill Road in Ashe Township, Monroe County. This was approximately 12 miles from the site of the Halloween party. He was using a bulldozer to clear heavy brush in a wooded portion of the land adjacent to a railroad track, when the machine malfunctioned after becoming stuck in mud. As John stepped off the machine to investigate, something captured his attention.
Well, he lifted up the box and it was like, I do remember this, it was up against a tree, so he had to let it down. And then I told him, let me go around back. I was on the phone at the time
with
my wife.
Uh-huh.
And I walked around the back of the truck to look, see if I get the dozer in there to push him out. And as I was walking over there, that's when I found the deceased.
John made a grim discovery, stumbling upon a partially skeletonized nude body. An apparent but futile attempt had been made to conceal the body, as two logs were found placed on top of it. The stark reality was that the body had been lying there for a considerable period.
My initial reaction was, I seen a tree on top, my initial reaction was I thought, right off my mind, that someone was in here trespassing and a tree fell on him. So I told my wife, I just found somebody, I gotta let you go, I gotta call the police.
Without hesitation, John contacted the police. Detective Brian Sroka was the first responder to the scene.
And it consists mostly of skeletal human remains, a little bit of flesh on the body and the lower extremities and the chest area. There's a log across the chest area and several other logs around the body.
The body was subsequently transported to the medical examiner's office for the determination of the cause of death and identification. Given the advanced state of decomposition, visual identification alone proved impossible. An anthropologist was called in to assist with the identification process. Just the very next day, the body was identified as Chelsea via dental records. Her cause of death was reported to be homicide, but the pathologist couldn't determine exactly how she had died. He said that more testing needed to be carried out, but Chelsea was the victim of murder. Detectives stressed that the owner of the land where Chelsea was found, John, was not involved in Chelsea's death in any way. He just so happened to own the land where she was found. That night, Chelsea's family released a heartfelt statement which read in part, "Thank you to everyone for your kind words and prayer during this difficult time. We worked tirelessly for 6 months to find Chelsea. She has been returned to us, and we take relief knowing she is with our Heavenly Father. Our faith is strong and we continue to put everything in God's hands. We appreciate everyone's time, help, and funding, no matter how big or small. Receiving this news has been devastating to our family. We spent our weekends with family and friends, sharing stories and memories of our Chelsea. We greatly appreciate the respect of our privacy." The missing person investigation swiftly transitioned into a murder investigation. Sheriff Dale Malone expressed their belief that Chelsea's murderer was somebody familiar with the railroad tracks near where her body was discovered. This location had once served as a common parking area, leading detectives to speculate that the perpetrator was well acquainted with the vicinity. As the investigation intensified, Chelsea's family organized a vigil on the 28th of the month. Hundreds of individuals attended to offer their condolences and pay their respects to the grieving family. Purple was the predominant colour worn by most attendees, symbolising the ongoing campaign to locate Chelsea. The atmosphere was solemn, and Chelsea's sister, Cassie, emotionally stated, "She was my best friend, and I'm going to miss her. She was so full of love, and she loved everyone." Leander remarked that if John hadn't exited his bulldozer when it malfunctioned, they might still be in the dark about Chelsea's whereabouts. On the 13th of June, Chelsea's loved ones gathered for her funeral service in Maybe. Many attendees donned purple attire, while others wore shirts bearing the words "Find Chelsea" on the front. Reverend John DeMass presided over the service and addressed the mourners with these words. "Our farewells should express our affection for her. In our sight she is dead, but in God's sight she will live forever." He said that Chelsea had crossed paths with somebody who chose dark and evil, before adding, "These are things we need to change. We have become a nation that lives in fear. We turn away and choose to ignore things we feel don't involve us. We have to have the light outshine the dark." The investigation persisted, but detectives had hit a brick wall. Nobody could offer any further insight into the man who was last seen with Chelsea, leaving them back at square one. Before her family knew it, it had been 1 year since her body was discovered. Chelsea's cause of death still hadn't been determined, As Sergeant Jeff Pauly commented, there is no ruling because he's not finished. It's still considered open. Thus far, detectives had conducted more than 800 interviews and had received almost 1,000 tips. In June, they released updated images of a person of interest they sought to interview. This individual had been present at the Halloween party and was believed to possess crucial information. He was described as a white man with dark hair and a slender mustache. During the party, he sported a black hoodie paired with a black leather vest, distressed jeans adorned with front holes, and a wallet chain. Eyewitnesses recounted that he predominantly spent his time under the tent near the front of the stage where the bands performed. Just a few days later, the man featured in the photograph was positively identified, and he voluntarily surrendered to detectives. He affirmed that he had encountered Chelsea that night, but he denied any involvement in her murder. Without hesitation, he provided a DNA sample, and upon analysis, it didn't match the DNA recovered from Chelsea's costume. Detectives found themselves at a crossroad once more, but it wouldn't be long before a new suspect surfaced, propelling the case wide open. On the afternoon of the 22nd of July, Deanna Boring found herself at her friend Kelly Richards' home. Kelly shared her home at the Frenchtown Villa Mobile Home Park with her boyfriend, a 27-year-old man named Daniel Clay. However, Kelly wasn't present at the home at the time. Daniel Clay was in the living room while Deanna was taking a shower. Suddenly, she heard a loud thumping on the front door. Deanna quickly got out of the shower, dressed herself, but seconds later, Clay burst into the bathroom and exclaimed, "Deanna, I'm going to prison." To her surprise, Clay refused to open the front door and started shouting to Kelly that he was going to be arrested. Just moments later, detectives forcefully entered the home, ordering Daniel Clay to the ground and subsequently arresting him. As Clay was being transported to Monroe County Jail, Kelly returned home to find it filled with detectives. They separated her and Deanna, initiating an interrogation about their relationship with Clay. Kelly ultimately consented to a search warrant, allowing detectives to meticulously search her entire home as she desperately sought information. Soon after, Kelly received the shocking news that her boyfriend Daniel Clay had become the primary suspect in Chelsea's murder. The search at the home persisted, and in Clay's bedroom, detectives came across a backpack. Inside, they found Chelsea's underwear and jewellery. The arrest of Daniel Clay sent shockwaves through their community, leaving those who knew him in disbelief. His girlfriend Kelly commented, "It's hard to believe you get to know someone and start falling in love, and he tells you he loves you. And the next thing you know, he's getting arrested for a murder." That evening, Clay called Jessica Preble from jail. Jessica was Clay's ex-girlfriend and they shared a son together. He bluntly stated, "I'm really sorry. Tell our son I love him, that I miss him." He called back sometime later and left a voicemail. In the voicemail, he said that he was going away for a really long time and that he had fucked up. At the time of his arrest, Daniel Clay was a familiar face to law enforcement. In April 2007, he experienced his initial encounter with the legal system, admitting guilt to a misdemeanor charge related to marijuana possession. By July of the same year, he had pleaded guilty to another misdemeanor, this time for breaking into a vehicle with the intent to steal property, valued at less than $200. The following month, he faced and ultimately confessed to charges of assault and battery, as well as retail fraud. In July 2008, he found himself arrested once more, this time for breaking into a coin box, to which he later pleaded guilty. Within the very next month, he accepted responsibility for a misdemeanor larceny charge, involving an amount between $200 and $1,000. In December of 2014, he pleaded guilty to a marijuana possession charge, and then again in March of 2016 for a similar offence. However, on the 10th of May, he committed a theft, stealing a backpack containing approximately $700 worth of tattoo equipment. This act led to a felony charge that carried a potential 10-year sentence. In 2015, a new law had taken effect, permitting law enforcement to collect DNA samples for individuals arrested for specific felonies. Previously, DNA could only be obtained following a conviction. Consequently, when Clay was apprehended in 2016, his DNA was promptly collected as part of the standard procedure and sent to the crime lab for inclusion in the DNA database. In July, the results of this analysis revealed that Clay's DNA was a precise match to the DNA discovered on Chelsea's poison ivy costume. By now, further testing had discovered that Chelsea had died from blunt force trauma to the head. She had sustained multiple facial fractures and two chipped teeth. There was also speculation that she may have been asphyxiated, but due to the condition of her remains, it couldn't be determined for sure. After Daniel Clay was transported to jail, he was taken into the interrogation room. Once he sat down, detectives began peppering him with small talk. He told them that he was the father of two children, but had struggled with homelessness in the past.
Daniel Clay.
Yep.
So, Jefferson.
Yeah.
You quit in 07?
No, it was 05 I quit. 07 was when I should have graduated.
Because
okay. I was only in the 10th grade.
Okay, so you got your GED or your
diploma? I was 2 credits short of my diploma.
Really?
My real mom kicked me out.
Really?
Like, the state made me go live with her. They said, oh, well, you can go either to the youth center for, like, it was, like, 7 months at that point. Until I turned 18, because, you know, I had no
guardian. Did you go to the youth center?
Or they said, you can go live with your real mom, who I'd never met.
He joked with detectives as he told them that he was popular with women. Detective Mike Predmore replied, you're a ladies' man. Clay admitted that he had been at the same Halloween party as Chelsea, and that he had seen his ex-girlfriend there.
I was at that party for 2 hours, and then went back to where I was staying up in Carlton.
So you were at the party?
Yeah. I seen my kid's mom actually there for
Pribble?
Yeah.
Okay. And Jessica Pribble?
Yeah.
Okay. Hold on. Let me write this down. You got a lot of girls in your life.
Okay.
Here.
I do have a lot of girls in my life.
She was at the party?
Mm-hmm. I wasn't with her there. She was with her new boyfriend. At the time, they were just... had just gotten together. It's now they have a kid together and stuff.
So what time did you go to the party?
About 8, 9. I was out of there about 10, 11.
Okay, so you went there at 8 or 9.
Yeah.
It was still daylight.
It was getting dark because it's October, you know.
You get there, you park, you get out, you say you got a half a pint, you start partying. What'd you do?
Just wandering around. Okay. Mainly, I spent most of the time talking with Jessica, my baby mom.
So, okay. Party, you're there, you see Jessica. You said you hung out with Jessica most of the time. What was you drinking off from her?
Fireball.
Oh.
I remember that.
What was your pint that you brought?
Vodka. It's always vodka.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm Syrah.
How much vodka did you drink?
I only drank, like, the half pint. Okay. And then I drank, you know, a couple shots of Fireball and stuff. But, like, I started getting a little tipsy, so... I won't lie. I drove drunk. I mean,
Your tipsy? I mean, I know what my tipsy is.
I don't get drunk.
Were you like?
I don't like. Brewing. Like if I'm standing here, like I'd be standing here like this. I might, you know, wobble a little bit, but you know, I could still do this number and stuff like that.
So you still had your wits too. You weren't laying down on the ground, laying in your puke.
No, I don't like to get drunk. I think it's retarded. Like if you get a buzz, I smoke weed. So to me, like. Getting a buzz and relaxing is what I want to do. I don't want to get stupid drunk and puke everywhere.
So a half pint, drink half pint.
I might have drank a pint total because I drank some of the Fireball too.
He was then asked whether he saw Chelsea that night, but he said he couldn't recall.
Not that I know.
I mean, she probably would have stood out if you saw her.
Yeah, but it's also been 2 years. I think I seem to remember like when this first started coming in the news and stuff that I remembered seeing her. Mm-hmm. Like that, the leafy shirt thing.
Yeah, poison ivy.
Yeah, it's pretty distinct, yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing that, but, like, just seeing her at the party.
He said that he hadn't seen Chelsea before the party either.
I mean, did you know, like, prior to the party?
Not prior to. Like, afterwards, because it was, like, 4 days, 5 days later, I went to go pick up
okay.
And she's like, do you know that my girl that I worked with, you know, come up missing, blah, 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 blah.
So you never met her there?
Never met her at the party, never seen her at her work.
Olga's?
Yeah, I did go into Olga's a few times to see Jessica, but I don't remember seeing her there either, you know?
Okay. Okay.
I mean, if she's not super hot or something like that, I don't pay attention. I'm shallow a little bit, I won't lie.
I understand. No, it's fine.
The detectives then ask Clay whether he had sex with Chelsea.
I got one more question. Have you ever had sex with her?
No.
Never?
No.
Okay.
I don't even... Like, I've never even flirted with her, never talked to her.
Never?
Nothing.
Nope.
No. Anything. Trust me, I'm a main whore. I remember every chick I've ever slept with, for the most part. Okay. And, yeah.
All right.
The detectives then left the room for a few moments before returning with more questions.
Would there be any reason that your DNA are on her clothes or
not
in her hair?
Not to my knowledge.
Or anywhere on her body?
No.
Okay.
Clay was then informed that his DNA had been found on Chelsea's clothing.
What if I told you that your DNA was on her?
I don't know how my DNA got on her.
Okay.
Like, no way, no nothing, no how.
Hey, listen, listen, Daniel, I am not trying to trick you. I'm looking you straight in your face, all right? I will actually show you, all right, what I have from the crime lab.
Okay.
All right? And I'm telling you that your DNA is on there.
I have no idea how.
So we need to figure out how it got there.
The questioning then became more intense. Clay claimed that he did see Chelsea and talked to her very briefly, but the interrogation continued. Clay then changed his story once more and said that he had a sexual encounter with a woman at the party.
Do you think that's where that DNA came from?
I mean, it could be, but I don't remember like her being in a costume. Like,
okay.
I remember it was just a girl in a t-shirt or something.
Okay.
I just...
Well, you know, said it.
Yeah, I'm saying it could be. I remember having sex with her, but she wasn't blonde. She had dark hair.
Well, she was wearing a wig.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it was a dark-haired chick, but fairly certain it wasn't her.
See?
And when I left alone. I didn't take her with me or nothing.
Detectives weren't buying Clay's story, and they continued to poke holes in it. He was informed that his DNA wasn't found in the form of semen, but instead from her costume where it had been torn. The detectives pushed him to confess.
Now is the time for you to tell us what happened, because are you that monster murderer?
No.
Did you have intention, but it just slipped? It got out of control?
No, I didn't do that to her.
Or was it an accident?
I had with a girl, that's it.
But then you have your DNA from where the tears are on her costume.
Clay claimed that after he left the party, he saw Chelsea walking along Post Road. He said that he pulled up alongside her and asked her if she needed a lift home. Chelsea climbed into the passenger seat, and according to Clay, they pulled over on Moore Road and had consensual sex in the back seat. He said that Chelsea began to bite and smack him and yelled at him to choke her.
She moved underneath me and said, choke me. I was choking her, and then she went limp. And I know it wasn't that long that I was choking her. Couldn't have been more than 20, 30 seconds, and I wasn't doing it extremely forceful to my knowledge.
Right.
Because I've had other girlfriends like to be choked.
According to Clay, he complied, but at some point she allegedly stopped breathing. He said that he attempted CPR on her, but to no avail. He was queried about the blunt force injuries Chelsea had sustained, and he was shown the gruesome photographs.
That's significant.
Yeah, that is. But unless I drop it on her face, I have no idea. I'm telling you.
But from 3 to 4 feet, I mean, I don't know how you can break a bone that like that. And I'm just a layperson here, but...
As the medical guy, because I walked down the tracks partway and across the road with her, so unless I, dropped her onto the tracks or the road, I know I didn't make it that far drunk carrying her that way.
After she died, did you slam her head up and down on a hard object?
I don't know. Like, I might have hit her against something, but not like that. Or I might have tried to smack her. Like, I might have hit her hard when I was smacking her, trying to get her to wake up, but not like that. Like, that's...
You're looking at the Braves.
I wasn't that messed up. I mean, I was drunk. I was fucked up, but not, like, to where I wouldn't know my own strength like that.
Clay said to the detectives that he was freaked out and began smacking and shaking Chelsea to try and wake her up. He said that he drove around with her body for the next half an hour. According to Clay, he eventually drove Chelsea out to the wooded area off Briar Hill Road and disposed of her. He said that he covered her with leaves, sticks, and logs. When asked about disposing of Chelsea's clothing, Clay claimed he had no recollection of throwing them away. He then told detectives he wasn't a murderer, before adding, "I couldn't kill a mouse." On the 25th of July, Daniel Clay was charged with the second-degree murder of Chelsea Brooke. During his court appearance, he asked for a lawyer and didn't object when the prosecutor argued for no bond. In a calm tone, he stated, "I don't want a bond." The reason Clay was only charged with second-degree murder was because prosecutors found no evidence that the murder of Chelsea was premeditated. A couple of days later, a psychiatric evaluation of Clay was ordered. His defense attorney, Russell Smith, said during court of his client, "For a lack of a better word, he was distraught. He was placed in the confinement cell for quite some time." While the psychiatric evaluations were ongoing, Clay was charged with rape in a separate incident. He was accused of entering an apartment and raping a woman inside on the 9th of June 2016. He was charged with first-degree home invasion and first-degree criminal sexual conduct. Towards the end of the month, Clay was found competent to stand trial. The next month, he was charged with concealing the death of an individual or disposing of a corpse in relation to Chelsea's murder. He was subsequently ordered to stand trial on a charge of open murder, which meant he could be convicted of either first-degree or second-degree murder. The trial was scheduled for May the next year, but before then, Clay was offered a plea deal. It would have included a 35-year prison sentence if he pleaded guilty to second-degree murder. However, Clay rejected the plea and he was bound over for trial. On the 9th of May 2017, the jury were seated and the trial was ready to commence. The courtroom was filled with all of Chelsea's loved ones, as Clay was escorted into the courtroom to take his place beside his defense team. During opening statements, prosecutor Michael Roerig told the jury of 13 women and one man that Chelsea had died from blunt force trauma to the head. He stated, "The young woman left in the woods had sustained massive blunt force injuries to the face. She would lie there for the next 6 months." He told the jury that Clay's DNA was discovered on Chelsea's bloodstained leotard, and then told them about his confession. He informed them that Clay had told multiple stories, first claiming he had never met Chelsea, before claiming she had died accidentally during rough sex. During defense attorney Russell Smith's opening statements, he did not deny that Chelsea had died at Clay's hands. However, he contended that Clay didn't intend to kill Chelsea, but was choking her during consensual sex. He said to the jury, "It is not illegal to engage in consensual sex with that element." He said that he didn't dispute that Clay made a bad choice in disposing of Chelsea's body, but said that his panic didn't prove guilt. Chelsea's mother was the first to testify, followed by several detectives. On the second day of the trial, the jury heard from John Marcon, the man who found Chelsea's body. During his testimony, photographs of Chelsea's remains were displayed in the courtroom. He said that a couple of months after finding Chelsea's remains, he found her second shoe on the grounds of his property. It matched the other shoe that had been found months earlier by a local homeowner. Several witnesses placed Clay at the Halloween party, but nobody had seen him speaking with Chelsea. Forensic evidence was then presented by Jennifer Risk, who said DNA on Chelsea's leotard matched Clay's DNA. She said that the cuts to the leotard Chelsea was wearing couldn't have been done with a sharp object such as a blade. Instead, she said it appeared to have been torn, possibly with the assistance of a blunt instrument. Dr. Megan Moore, a forensic anthropologist, testified that Chelsea had sustained 3 separate blows to the head. There was one at the lower side of each orbital socket, and another to the lower jaw. According to defense attorney Smith, the log found on top of Chelsea could have fallen and caused the broken bones in her face, post-mortem. Dr. Moore refuted this, replying that if the rock had fallen on top of her body, it would have broken the bridge of her nose. Dr. Lee Havelty then testified about the force required to cause such injuries. She stated, "These are the injuries that we typically see in motor vehicle accidents or assaults." She also said that she couldn't rule out strangulation as a possible cause of death. The most highly anticipated moment of the trial came when the jury got to hear Clay's confession. Following the video of his interrogation, Clay took to the witness stand on his own defense.
Mr. Clay, did you cause Chelsea Brooks' death?
Yes.
Did you intend to cause her death?
No, I did not.
He displayed very little emotion as he told the jury that he didn't mean for Chelsea to die.
Because I didn't mean for her to die. Didn't mean for this to end like this.
He said that he had ripped the crotch off Chelsea's costume while helping her remove it to have sex. The same as his interrogation, he claimed that Chelsea asked him to choke her. He testified, "When I released my hand, I didn't hear that intake of breath." He said that he pulled her out of the back seat and attempted CPR, but Chelsea was dead. In a cool and calm tone, he said, "I freaked out for a little while, not sure what to do." According to Clay, his cell phone was dead, so he couldn't call for help. He suggested that when he loaded Chelsea's body back into the car, he may have hit her head on the door.
I then sat her down in one spot and started to grab some sticks and put them on top of her. I just kept thinking, am I a monster that did this? And I'm not.
Following his testimony, the defense rested, and it was time for closing arguments. The prosecution said to the jury that Chelsea's facial injuries showed that she had been beaten, not accidentally asphyxiated. Prosecutor Michael Rohrig said to the jury, "Chelsea's face was smashed in. She suffered multiple blunt force blows to her face with heavy force. She could not consent to being strangled to death." Moreover, he said that the bloodstains to Chelsea's leotard were on the interior, which suggested she was beaten before it was torn from her body. The defense, on the other hand, suggested that Chelsea's death was an accident. Defense attorney Smith stated, "Chelsea Brooke died at his hands. It is a tragedy. He's not denying that." The jury were then sent off to deliberate. They needed to decide whether the murder of Chelsea was intentional, as prosecutors had claimed, or whether it was an accident, as the defense had claimed. They returned just 4 hours later and found Daniel Clay guilty of felony murder and concealing Chelsea Brooke's body. As the verdict was announced, Chelsea's family wept from the public gallery. It had taken 2.5 years, but now they finally had justice. Outside of court, Prosecutor Rohrig stated, "No amount of criminal justice can ever bring Chelsea back or the victim of any homicide. But I think the verdict does speak volumes about what the defendant did that day, and certainly brings some measure of justice to the family as well." The following month, Daniel Clay was convicted of sexual assault in the unrelated rape case. Then in July, it was time for him to be sentenced for Chelsea's murder. The courtroom was filled with all of her loved ones, and there were displayed collages depicting Chelsea's life from the day she was born until the day that she died. The courtroom fell silent as victim impact statements were presented. Chelsea's mother, Leanda, was wearing purple and a Crime Stoppers pin with Chelsea's face emblazoned on the front. She told Clay that she had forgiven him for killing her daughter and then handed him a Bible. She said that her forgiveness didn't mean that she would ever forget. Clay was then allowed to make a statement. He said, "I thank you for that Bible, and I will keep it as long as I'm able to. I'm sorry for everything.
I will live with this for every day for the remainder of my life. It'll be something that I will wake up thinking about, something that I will go to sleep thinking about."
We've done that for 33 months.
I'm sorry for everything.
Judge Daniel White then told Clay that he didn't believe his apology was genuine, telling him, "I spent 10 days in trial with Mr. Clay, and I listened to countless hours of him changing his story every time the detectives questioned him or brought up something new. It was very clear to me, Mr. Clay, you're a liar, a rapist, and a killer." He then sentenced Daniel Clay to life in prison. He was then sentenced to 40 to 75 years for the other sexual assault. Leanda spoke outside of court.
"I knew that if I did not forgive him, It would destroy me. It would eat away at me. And as I said in the courtroom, we all have to stand before our Lord someday and answer for what we did and did not do.
For weeks, Chelsea Brock had excitedly looked forward to the Halloween party, devoting painstaking attention to crafting her costume. However, that fateful night brought forth a disturbing truth, one that reminds us that there are individuals with nefarious intentions who may prey on lone and vulnerable women. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Elizabeth. Morbidology is just a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way, and I really am thankful. Please check it out if you want bonus episodes that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, as well as a handwritten thank you card and some cool merch. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read some true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.